Everybody's calm today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. North Korea agrees to shut down some nuclear sites. Kim Jong-un calls it a leap forward and asks the U.S. to respond in kind. President Trump says it's tremendous progress.
But in the meantime, we're talking. It's very calm. He's calm. I'm calm. So we'll see what happens.
Also today, Puerto Rico, a year after Hurricane Maria. In one coastal community, people are still wrestling with how much it would cost to rebuild and whether they even should.
If the government says you have to leave and here's this much money, that's one thing. But if they don't tell you anything, you have to fix what you have.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Glad you could make it here today. Another day, another summit for North Korea and South Korea. South Korean President Moon Jae-in traveled to the North Korean capital, Pyongyang, where Kim Jong-un hosted again. They stood side by side on a stage, and the two men promised to work toward lasting peace. That's Kim Jong-un, a voice we don't often hear. He's talking about turning the Korean Peninsula into a land of peace without nuclear weapons and nuclear threats. The North said it would dismantle key facilities and allow inspectors into the country. South Korea's president made that announcement today. Moon Jae-in also spoke of a follow-up summit. Moon said he invited Kim to visit Seoul and that he has accepted. Here in the U.S., President Donald Trump spoke to reporters briefly today, and he welcomed the news out of North Korea.
A lot of people thought it was inevitable we were going to war. And now the relationships, I have to tell you, at least on a personal basis, they're very good. It's very much calmed down.
He's calm, I'm calm, Trump said, referring to Kim Jong-un. The president says tremendous progress is being made with North Korea. We're going to look more closely at what Kim Jong-un appears to be offering, starting with his pledge to dismantle the nuclear facility at Yongbyon. That's a place U.S. intelligence agencies have been watching for years. Soo Mi-Terry is currently the Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, and she's skeptical.
The destruction of the Yongbyon site will be an excellent photo op. It makes it look like North Korea is taking a significant step. But they've done something like that in 2008 when they blew up a cooling tower. North Korea still has many nuclear arsenal, dozens of warheads. They have extensive uranium mining and enrichment facilities. And we know from the intelligence community that North Korea has been working on nuclear and missile program all the time. Their production, the fissile material, and everything else. So they want to make it look like they're making progress, but without really giving up nuclear weapons. And by the way, Kim Jong-un has said that he will do this only if the United States give some sort of countermeasure. We give something on our side. And of course, by that, they mean end of war declaration.
Right. So right now, this is a bilateral conversation between the North and the South. Don't we need an international framework to make this truly successful?
Absolutely. Not only international. If there is no progress made between United States and North Korea, President Moon, no matter how much he wants to advance this, he's going to hit roadblocks. Like right now, he has committed to deepening inter-Korean cooperation on the economic front. He wants to possibly open Kaesong Industrial Complex. That's a joint industrial complex between North and South Korea that they used to run. He wants to do, you know, the railway, open the railways and all of this. But they are right now under sanctions regime. Like, there will be a violation of the United Nations sanctions. So even if President Moon wants to do all this, he's not going to be able to unless he violates UN sanctions that we have on the North Korean regime. So to truly make progress, there has to be a progress made between United States and North Korea.
You know, the Wall Street Journal says this is a bold gambit taken by Kim Jong-un. Do you think that's a fair read?
No, I don't think it's a bold gambit. I think Kim Jong-un has a strategy and a plan, and all of the things that he's doing are fitting into that strategy, and it's working quite well for him. He has said in the New Year's address in 2018 that he's now done with testing. So I don't think there's going to be any more provocations. You know, Pakistan tested 6 times, and he didn't test anymore. North Korea does not need to continually test. What they truly want is an international acceptance of North Korea as a responsible nuclear weapons power. He wants that acceptance, and I think he wants to buy time. He wants to make incremental progress. He thinks there's a possibility under this president, President Trump, that perhaps he can eventually get a peace treaty from the United States, which would have implications for U.S.-South Korea alliance commitment, U.S. troop presence in South Korea. And I think that's where he wants to go. And he thinks he sees an opportunity there. So he's giving this kind of gifts, which is like, you know, where we blow up a facility that's no longer needed or testing facility and so on. But I think he has a strategy of what he wants, and he's achieving that in a way. I don't think it's bold yet. I mean, what have we seen in terms of Kim making moves, taking active measures towards denuclearization?
So let's say Moon Jae-in sits down with Donald Trump at the General Assembly in New York. What happens if they come out of that with some kind of end-of-war deal, like an armistice? How does that change the process? How does that change the landscape?
Well, I think he might get that because President Trump is eager to see this as an incentive, and maybe President Moon will get that. And then we'll see. Once we have that end-of-war declaration, the concern is that it's a slippery slope towards an actual peace treaty. And while peace treaty sounds good in theory because it really ends the war, why not have peace on the Korean Peninsula? Again, the problem with that is that has real implication for our troops staying in South Korea and U.S.-South Korea alliance relationship. But in return, if we can get North Korea to completely give up their nuclear weapons, that's fine, but we might not be able to. Right now, we don't even have a declaration from North Korea of all their nuclear and missile programs in the inventory. And many scientists and experts believe verification itself, even if there is a deal, will take some 15 years. Just decommissioning one site will take a decade. So this is the goal, I think, for Kim Jong-un, you know, get a deal, get to a peace treaty, get the U.S. troops off the Korean Peninsula, yet he retains still nuclear weapons program. Because all he has to do is incrementally give some sort of concession that makes it look like North Korea is headed in that direction. But I don't truly believe that North Korea will give up their nuclear weapons program.
Dr. Sue Mi Terry, the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Greatly appreciate your time. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
The new Bob Woodward book, Fear, is full of insider accounts out of the Trump White House. It might also shed some light on a fascinating link between North Korea and the Ozarks.
And Woodward's book says that from October 17th to 19th of 2017, the U.S. Air Force ran an elaborate series of simulated airstrikes in the Missouri Ozarks.
That simulation was all about North Korean military targets. Last year, there was speculation that the Trump administration was seriously considering a preemptive attack. Since then, things have been dialed back, but we were intrigued by this report about war games in the Ozarks of Arkansas and Missouri, like, why the Ozarks? The Defense Department doesn't like to get into details about things like classified war games. Jeffrey Lewis has some insight, though. He's an expert in nuclear nonproliferation and geopolitics at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. And we'll get to what was happening reportedly in the Ozarks last year in a moment, Jeffrey. But first, you wrote the speculative novel, the 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States. It's about a war with North Korea. Just remind us briefly about some of your speculations in the novel.
Well, you know, the novel is really a story of how bad decisions could lead us down a very dark path. And so it's a kind of story about how signaling and counter-signaling can get all messed up. And people can think a war is coming when it's not. And if they think that, then actually the war can come. So in some ways, it's very appropriate to this revelation.
Region and geography and war are what we're looking at here. I suppose if you want your military well briefed on where they're going to attack, you want them accustomed to a certain landscape, right?
You know, I mean, one of the reasons that the U.S., I think, did so well for the conventional operations portions of both Gulf Wars is that the Army has a giant desert training center out at Fort Irwin. And, you know, I think one of the interesting questions for the Army now is as they focus on Korea missions, you know, that training center at Fort Irwin doesn't really look like North Korea. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's one of the great advantages of the U.S. military is that they train so much. And I think one of the challenges is often finding terrain that's suitable so that when troops find themselves in a situation like that, that they're not totally confused and doing it for the first time.
So this is kind of standard operating procedure as a country prepares for war. What is the most difficult topography when it comes to strikes on nuclear facilities? I know we're kind of in uncharted territory here.
You know, it's a really interesting debate, honestly, that we have, because, you know, you would think that the flat, desertless terrain of Iraq would have been very favorable. But the U.S. didn't manage to destroy a single Iraqi missile prior to launch, because even though it was a big, flat, empty desert, it was big and missiles were able to hide. North Korea is a very different kind of terrain. It's very mountainous. There are fewer roads, but there are lots of trees, and mountains tend to hide things, and you know, but it's smaller. So there's a big debate about whether North Korea would be tougher or easier. I tend to be of the view that even if it's smaller, the fact that there are so many mountains and so many underground facilities and so many trees means it's probably impossible to go and get everything.
And what do we know about North Korea's nuclear facilities? Are they hidden in those valleys and mountains and trees?
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the interesting things we do here at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies, where I work, is we spend a lot of time looking at facilities in satellite pictures. And, you know, just the other day, we were looking in a region where we have mapped out many of the defense facilities, and we found three giant underground facilities that we had never seen before, and we don't have the slightest idea what they're for. So, you know, if you spend any time looking at North Korea, you would know how much tunneling there is. And, you know, often there's not much of a hint. You know, it's just there's some, well, we call it spoil, you know, rock at the mouth of the tunnel that they dug out, and then there's an entrance, and, you know, what's inside is left to the imagination.
In your novel, Jeffrey, did the U.S. simulate airstrikes as they were going to war against North Korea, and where did they happen?
Well, so in the novel, I don't go into the simulation, but there is a sort of long discussion of trying to get ready for a conflict. And what the Air Force wants to do in the novel, and what I actually worry that may happen and could be very dangerous, is they start running bomber runs right up to the North Korean border, right where the airspace begins, wait for the North Koreans to turn on their air defense radars, and then turn around and come home, which is a thing that you would want to do if you wanted to map out where the air defenses were, because you plan to want to get around them and go hit a target. That's something the United States really did against the Soviet Union in the early 1980s. It scared the Soviets so much that they went on all kinds of alert and eventually shot down a Korean airliner, KL-007. And, you know, spoilers, but in the book, the same thing happens. We expect our military to be ready, and we expect them to be prepared. But I do think we have to also be aware that other countries are watching those preparations, and they may draw conclusions from those preparations that are not exactly accurate.
Jeffrey Lewis is an expert in nuclear nonproliferation. He's also the author of the 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States, a novel. Jeffrey, thanks for being on the show again.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
So, the Ozarks.
Similar to North Korea.
We're just when you think you've heard it all.
Who knew?
Yeah.
TV anchors from KY3 in Springfield, Missouri there. A little gobsmacked. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
My name is Stephanie. I'm 22, and I live in Puerto Rico.
Exactly. 1 year ago, Stephanie Rivera was bracing for Hurricane Maria. The impact, as we know, was devastating. Here's Stephanie with some of her story.
After Maria, I lost everything, and I had no place to go. My apartment got flooded. I have some people in my family pass away for Maria. I lost my furniture, clothes. I had nothing, nothing. My son lost his bed and, you know, things that I worked hard for. And even my puppy passed away and everything. And thank God I had some friends there around me. They took me in. They helped me with me and my son. My son at the time, he was only 3. He was still using diapers, still didn't get potty trained at the time. So they would buy him diapers, milk, and everything like that. And, you know, they gave us food, a place to stay for a month and a half. And then after that, my grandma was so – I finally got in contact with my grandma. And she was like, I'm going to come and get you. You can do more over here. So I went to New York for 3 months and – try to save up my money. My grandmother helped me out a lot. And then I was like, I started to think about all those special good moments I had here in Puerto Rico. And, you know, this is my island, and I always come back home. So I came back home, and I said, I got this. I could do this. I'm a fighter. I love to work hard and get my things and work for the things that, you know, I want, and I want in the future for me and for my son. So I came back to Puerto Rico, and I was like, I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to get my stuff together. I'm going to get my apartment, and I, you know, one step at a time. So, yeah, I left, and I did came back. But it was hard, and I'm glad I did, though. I had the people that I had around me, because if not, who knows where I would have been. In a lot of ways, it made me appreciate more of the things that like I have now, and to always, you know, work hard and to do more, because in one split second, you know, you lose everything. You're like, what am I going to do next? So, yeah, it does, you know, change. Like, you just want to work hard and save up more and appreciate the things you have.
Wow, I never thought about that. No diapers. How are you going to potty train an infant? Stephanie Rivera is now back on her feet. We spoke with her at work. She's waiting tables at a bar in Luquillo, Puerto Rico. Most people on the island rode out the storm by choice or by necessity, and since then, it's been a very rough ride for a lot of people. For some, there's still no end in sight. Reporter Irina Jora visited one tiny community on Puerto Rico's coast that's still coming to terms with what the storm did.
Rosie Mastachi Dominguez is 54 and comes from a family of fishermen. Some four generations back, her ancestors claimed a little piece of shoreline on the north-central coast of Puerto Rico. They built a house on the black speckled sand, looking out onto palms and blue-green water.
Aquí criaron a mis abuelos. Mis abuelos a mis
My grandparents grew up here. My grandparents raised my parents here. And my parents raised us.
The tight-knit community, now known as La Boca, has a deep sense of place. And it was shocking when Hurricane Maria struck last September.
The area has completely changed.
The beach lost approximately 90% of the beach width.
That's geologist Maritza Barreto. She says Maria's waves clawed away at the sand. It left La Boca defenseless.
The beach works as a buffer of all the energy from the swells and the storm waves.
But Maria didn't directly damage the homes. That came later, in February, when another weather system brought huge waves. Without the beach to protect them, Mastachi and her neighbors watched nervously.
We were watching and waiting and thinking, the sea always comes up to there. It won't get to us. We never thought the sea would reach us. Never.
But it did. Mastache leads me up to her house. Clothes hang on a line and the driveway is neatly swept. But when the door gives, we're greeted by the smell of Clorox mixed with ocean. The home is empty. A deep crack runs up one wall and down the next.
The sea split the house in half.
Where the entire back of the house used to be, there's nothing. The waves scooped sand from underneath it until whole rooms collapsed. The family moved out and closed the gaping hole with a metal sheet. Their neighbors helped buy a pile of rocks. As we talk, a worker riding a small machine is reinforcing the foundation.
He's trying to bring some rocks here and put them up against the house.
Just beyond, a neighbor's bathroom, walls and all, lies in the sand. Six houses and a handful of businesses were damaged in La Boca, but the problem repeats all over the island. Even before Maria, more than half of Puerto Rico's beaches were eroding, partly because building on the coast can disrupt natural cycles of sand movement. That's a problem when nearly everyone lives along the coasts.
Most of the economic activity of Puerto Rico occurs also in the coastal areas.
This is Ernesto Diaz. He's director of the Puerto Rico Coastal Zone Management Program. He says all the electric power stations are also located on the coast.
You have a sanitary infrastructure, you have power transmission lines, fiber optic cables.
Diaz says erosion is a natural process. Sea levels also vary naturally over time. But human actions have sped those things up.
If sea level rise is increasing and at an accelerated pace, and we're losing beaches also at an accelerated pace, and we humans made ourselves vulnerable by building so close to the coastline, obviously what were formerly natural processes are now social problem.
Today, Puerto Rican law prohibits construction on beaches. Some developers still manage to do it, but many of the structures on the coast here were built before the laws passed. Places like the Mastache family's house in La Boca. As these beachside properties succumb to the weather or just time, people are not supposed to rebuild them. So when I tell Diaz how the community is rebuilding, he sits up straight.
If people are dumping rocks to protect properties as we speak, they are doing so illegally.
Rosie Mastache knows all this, but she says the government hasn't told them to stop rebuilding. Enforcement is notoriously lax. No one has stopped them, but no one is helping them to relocate either. The weather system that ultimately damaged homes in La Boca was not a federally declared disaster, so people here don't qualify for the emergency money that other families got after Maria. Mastache says without aid, many in her low-income community don't have the option of moving.
If the government comes and says, you have to leave and here's this much money for you to get out, that's one thing. But if they don't tell you anything, you have to fix what you have.
She also knows there's a good chance that the house, even if it is rebuilt, will be wrecked again by the sea. I ask her if living here seems sustainable.
No. No.
And yet, she says the affected families all want to return. As she locks up the front door, another door that once led to a bedroom flies open. Through it, we can see the ocean waves break in the near distance. For the world, Irina Jorov, La Boca, Puerto Rico.
Irina's story was produced with a grant from the Society of Environmental Journalists Fund for Environmental Journalism. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. American farmers are plenty worried. They fear President Trump's trade policy is already cutting into their bottom line. But this Kansas soybean grower is not one of them.
I still support him, and I'm going off of what he said earlier, be patient. And I'm going to sit here and be patient for a while.
That story is still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here's what a trade war looks like. The Trump administration once again slaps new tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. And China responds, announcing $60 billion in tariffs on U.S. goods. President Trump is now threatening even more tariffs, and he lashed out at Beijing in a tweet warning there will be great and fast economic retaliation against China if our farmers, ranchers, and or industrial workers are targeted. For some reaction to the escalating U.S.-China trade war, we called up Mike White.
Everything's going great here. We're picking corn as we speak.
Mike White farms corn and soybeans and raises cattle in Bellevue, Kansas, with his two brothers. We caught up with him on his cell phone and asked him what this trade war means for his bottom line.
In our business, grain prices have fallen dramatically. So that's been a big problem here. Our local elevator, I think, right now is paying $3.07 for corn, which is far below what break-even price would be.
And do you draw a connection between that low price and the tariffs?
Sure, absolutely. Soybeans are the same way. We're waiting on seeing how this is going to turn out. We haven't lost hope yet. We're cautiously optimistic.
So how worried are you that this trade war is not going to end, that it's just going to go on for a while?
I think eventually it'll work itself out, and we're going to wait and see. Now, don't get me wrong, cash flow is the name of the game. And if the producer is sitting well with bills and whatnot, he should be able to hold out. But eventually, we got to get something moving or else it's going to get a lot of people in trouble.
Yeah, so what kind of calendar are we talking about? Half a year?
I'd say 6 months.
Yeah.
After the first of the year, something hasn't changed. You know, tax season rolls around for a lot of people about that time. That's a big difference. They need cash flow by then.
So, Mike, is this hitting you? Are these tariffs hitting you in the wallet right now?
Yes, because of low prices. But we're better off than a lot of people because we have livestock. And cheap grain makes for cheap meat. And I understood that our exports have picked up a lot in 2018 versus 2017. So every mouthful that of grain that a hog or a steer can eat is just something else out of the grain bins around here.
Yeah. I mean, you may or may not know that in the last 24 hours, China has now hit back, including a 10% additional tariff on meat. So I'm just wondering, the doors are progressively closing for your other options, too.
Well, and I agree with what you're saying, and I've heard it also, but you and I don't know how many back doors there are open on this deal that goes through other channels to get there. The people in China still got to eat, in my opinion. That's what I'm banking on.
Over the years, have you been a believer in free trade?
Yes.
What benefits has it brought you?
Well, our exports have just opened up so much more. It's just increased tremendously.
And you're a Trump supporter, right?
Yes.
And you still support him even though these tariffs have basically done a 180 on the benefits that you've reaped so far?
Yes, I still support him, and I'm going off of what he said earlier, be patient. And I'm going to sit here and be patient for a while.
Is your support today still as strong as it was a month ago, before all the tariffs began with China?
Yes.
But as you say, 6 months, we'll see how this is all coming together, and you need cash, as you say.
Absolutely, and I'm sure there's a lot of people in the same boat.
What about the other farmers that you work with there in Kansas around Bellevue? I mean, do they support Trump? Have they stopped supporting him because of the tariffs?
In our area, I think there's a lot of Trump support in this area.
And what does the conversation sound like when you meet people at the feed store, at the coffee shop?
They're behind Trump, and they're more disappointed in the way the rest of the government works. People are tired of it. All the wasted time and money in Washington.
So they support Trump, but they're tired of government being on their back.
Basically, yeah.
Mike White farms corn and soybeans and raises cattle in Bellevue, Kansas, with his two brothers. Mike, thanks very much for being with us.
All right. See you.
Have a good day.
You too.
So that's one American farmer who wants to give President Trump's trade policies some time to work. Others want to de-escalate the trade war with China as soon as possible. Brian Keel is the executive director of Farmers for Free Trade. Are you also a farmer, Brian?
I am not. I work for an agricultural firm, but I'm not myself a farmer.
But I suppose you spend a lot of time talking to farmers. The trade war with China escalated again this week, as you know. What regions or industries will be affected the most by the U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods and now China's retaliation?
You know, in terms of agriculture, pretty much all sectors are impacted, whether you're a soybean grower in the Midwest or a almond grower in California, you know, a hog farmer in the Southeast, pretty much wherever you are, if you're in agriculture, this trade war is impacting you.
Tell me about the specific concerns you've been hearing from farmers you've spoken with recently. How have tariffs hurt their livelihood since the trade war began this summer?
So Farmers for Free Trade has been at multiple events, Iowa State Fair, Minnesota Farm Fest, Commodity Classic. Every place there are a large number of farmers. And what we hear consistently is farmers are getting squeezed by the trade war. They're getting squeezed because their input costs are higher. So the cost for a tractor, the cost for a combine, for a grain bin, those costs have all gone up as steel and aluminum costs have gone up. They're also getting squeezed because commodity prices are coming down. As China's putting tariffs on our products, we're selling less of our products, so our prices are dropping. So soybeans, for example, have dropped 20% since the start of the trade war. So for a farmer, you're getting squeezed both on how much it costs you to grow your food, and then you're getting squeezed on how much you can sell your food for.
What was the mood at the Iowa State Fair? I'm just curious. I mean, was there anger at Washington or anger at Beijing or both?
I would say both. You know, I mean, agriculture is not homogenous. You have a lot of farmers with a lot of opinions. I think one thing that's worth noting, agriculture supported President Trump in America. Rural America voted strongly for President Trump. I think most farmers start from a position of we're willing to give him some leeway. I think that's where most people start. I think what you're seeing is as the trade war bites, as people start to lose money or they harvest their crop and they see that they're going to lose money if they sell it, those attitudes are shifting, and I think people are losing patience. And I think the longer the trade war goes on, the more patience people are going to lose.
Tell us a bit about your campaign with your organization. The campaign's called Tariffs Hurt the Heartland. What is the goal?
Farmers for Free Trade is a bipartisan, non-political organization, Republicans and Democrats working together to support trade that's good for agriculture. We've launched a campaign with a number of other businesses called Tariffs Hurt the Heartland. We're holding town hall meetings. We're holding press events to raise awareness about how trade benefits producers, be it manufacturers or farmers, and how tariffs are hurting them. Our goal is to get the trade war de-escalated and eventually ended.
So what do you see as a trend, kind of a slow leak of support for Trump on the tariffs?
Yes, and I think that will accelerate. One thing that's important to recognize is for most agriculture, we haven't been in harvest. That's just happening now in the fall. Now, there's some like milk. Milk has been seeing prices decline, and that's obviously harvested on a daily basis. You look at soybeans or almonds. Those are just going into harvest now. Apples, fresh produce. So the bite is really happening starting now. And I think the more that people experience that firsthand impact, the less happy they're going to be with the decision to go into a major trade war.
And yet, as you say, a lot of farmers are in red states. Many of them voted for Trump and support Trump, partly because Trump managed to connect with them on policies that hit their wallets through globalization. You still empathize with those farmers who support Trump?
Sure. I mean, I think a lot of those farmers are members of Farmers for Free Trade and support Trump on what he's done with taxes or what he's done with deregulation. It's possible to support someone and still disagree with them. It's sort of like my daughter the other day got in a wreck with my pickup truck. I still support my daughter. I'm not pleased that she dented the side of my truck, but I still love her dearly. And I think that's not a bad thing.
Brian, I'm sorry to hear about your pickup truck. Is your daughter okay?
She was fine. It was a big truck. It just has a little dent. But, you know, the bigger point, you know, we can agree to disagree on points, but still support someone. And we think it's really important that President Trump hears directly from farmers how they're being impacted by the trade war.
Brian Keel, Executive Director of Farmers for Free Trade. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Here now is a story about Detroit, a city filled with ruins, and one of the most iconic is the Packard plant. It's a complex of 43 abandoned buildings on the east side of Detroit. In 2013, a Spanish developer living in Peru bought the facility on foreclosure. The price tag was $450,000. Progress of the plant has been slow, too slow for many, but now there are some signs of movement. The World's Jason Margolis has this update.
The group Pure Detroit gives tours of the city's gleaming landmarks and its skeletons. On a rainy day, Jacob Jones takes me through the former Packard factory, sprawling shells of concrete with graffiti and rubble. Think Mad Max or a bombed-out city.
That's why so many movies are filmed here, is because it has that sort of post-apocalyptic look.
In its heyday a century ago, a Packard automobile meant luxury. And the company wanted a factory to reflect that.
They bring in the architect Albert Kahn to develop this new form of steel-reinforced concrete. At its peak, the Packard plant occupied more than 4 million square feet and had over 40,000 people working on site.
During World War II, Packard shifted to wartime production, but after that, the company couldn't get its footing back. In the mid-1950s, the last Packard rolled off the line in Detroit. By the 1970s, the plant sat rotting and abandoned, too expensive to tear down. And there was always a hope that it would someday find new life.
I want you to imagine looking in this place. You see these sort of gutted out areas. You see cinder block all over the place. Imagine windows. Anywhere you see cinder block, you would have had massive windows that would have let natural light pour through and natural air pour through.
The developer, Fernando Palazuelo, apparently saw that. He has a track record renovating historical buildings in Peru, Spain, and Nepal. Palazuelo has said he'll turn the Packard plant into residential units, commercial spaces, restaurants, and an art gallery. I reached out to Palazuelo's company for this story, but they declined an interview with him. But 5 years ago, he told us that he fell in love with the city of Detroit and its real estate prices.
When I began to buy in Lima, I'm paying $100 per square meter, when in Spain it was $10,000 or $12,000. In Detroit, I am paying $1.3 per square meter, already constructed.
That's 9,000 times cheaper than in Spain. But there's a reason for the deep discount in Detroit.
Do we need more office space? Not unless we get more tenants.
Jim Bieri runs a real estate firm in downtown Detroit. He's rooting for Palazuelo, but says they've seen outside developers come by pieces of Detroit before.
A lot of times you see people come in and it's years before anything happens.
It took 4 years just to start cleaning up the Packard plant last year. During that time, Detroit's downtown core has made a steady comeback. Walk just outside Bieri's downtown office and you see an area buzzing with restaurants, food carts, and a new streetcar. But the Packard plant is more than 4 miles from here.
The Packard plant is surrounded by neighborhoods in which probably 40 to 50% of the homes have disappeared.
Reynolds Farley teaches about the history of Detroit at the University of Michigan. He says restoring the Packard plant would be a long shot. The developer, Fernando Palazuelo, has said it could be a $500 million project. Farley doesn't see the business case, but he's glad somebody does. In Detroit, the Packard plant isn't just any old place.
Symbolically, it would be tremendous for Detroit if some parts of that plant were restored. It is such an iconic plant because of the history of the Packard automobile, because of the war efforts there in World War II. It would be amazingly satisfying to see some positive developments there.
And while Packard still looks like a ruin, locals say it's already come a long way.
It's a complete difference.
Christopher Burns lives down the street and works here supervising the cleanup, removing debris.
We had a lot of stone and brick lying around. Been a lot of that's been removed.
Burns says before Fernando Palazuelo stepped in, things were bad here. Real bad.
Demoralizing, so to speak, because before he came, there, you know, they used to find people in there. They used to find dogs roaming around, fires being set every week.
Yeah, so when you said people, you meant alive and dead.
Oh, no, dead.
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 Burns seems optimistic, though, about the future and his new boss in Peru.
Oh, he's a real, very nice guy. Very personable, mannerable. He dresses very well. He's very in touch with what's going on. He has a pulse on the city. He's the only one of the only ones that I know, and maybe some others, but he's the only one that's taking a very great risk in coming to the inner city and revitalizing and plans to bring jobs to this area.
And while many have doubts about his vision, Palazuelo has urged patience that the project could take up to 15 years. If he pulls it off, urban experts say it could be among the world's most ambitious, difficult, and improbable redevelopment projects in decades. For The World, Jason Margolis, Detroit.
Just ahead on the show, a 6-year protest in the trees may be coming to an end in Germany. This is The World. Marco Werman here with The World. Let's pay a quick visit to a village in Germany. It's not one of those medieval ones.
I am talking to you from a cozy town in the treehouse called Lump. It is a village of 50 tree houses.
That's a woman who calls herself Susie. We spoke with her earlier today from a treehouse in Germany's Hambacher Forest. Dozens of protesters have been living in this treehouse for the past 6 years. Yes, 6 years.
For generations, there has been open pit brown coal mining in the region, taking away more and more of Europe's largest mixed forest. And we live here all through the year to stop the people from cutting the forest down.
This is an ancient forest and is owned by the mining company, RWE. RWE now wants to expand its coal production there, and police have been evicting the protesters.
This morning, they started surrounding the treehouse with police and then started clearing the forest around the tree houses to make way for cherry pickers. Then they have climbing police trying to enter the treehouse, and then they try to put ropes around several people, and they pull the ropes so the person is dragged through the branches onto the cherry picker.
The protesters say they've been living in the trees next to the mine to send a message. They want to shed light on the world leaders who made promises to end the use of greenhouse gas-producing fuels. Chancellor Angela Merkel, for example, she's promised to phase out coal, but has not yet given a timeline. And currently in Germany, 40% of the country's electricity comes from coal-fired power plants.
At the same time that they are evicting us here, we have had an extreme hot summer simply here in Germany. Floods are flooding Florida, the Philippines, and China. And it seems like politicians that are making decisions here don't understand how that is connected. It's about climate justice.
RWE is expected to begin cutting down trees for its expansion next month. Susie says when that happens, the protesters will be back and in greater numbers. And finally, 1 year ago today, a 7.1 magnitude earthquake struck Mexico City and surrounding areas. 369 people were killed. Last year, reporter Emily Green brought us a story of Wesley Boxey. He's an acclaimed photojournalist who lived in Mexico City for nearly two decades. The apartment where he and his family were living collapsed in the quake. He survived, but his wife did not. Today, Boxey is rebuilding his life in Colorado with his young daughter. Here's Emily with their story.
The earthquake hit on a Tuesday afternoon. Wesley Boxey was at home with his wife, Elizabeth. Their daughter was at school. They lived on the eighth floor of an old building in the trendy Mexico City neighborhood of Condesa. Wesley remembers the apartment shaking. He and Elizabeth ran up to the roof like they did during other earthquakes.
You know, the building would shake and then it would stop shaking and it would be over and we would go on to our regular routine. Except this time it didn't.
The building collapsed beneath them like giant domino pieces. Wesley and Elizabeth were found seriously injured on the street, buried under a large tree. First responders said Wesley was coherent and talking, but he doesn't remember that. Only when he woke up in the hospital a month later.
My whole body was messed up. I mean, I had 18 fractures. I suffered 18 fractures. It's a miracle. It's a miracle I'm even alive.
Seven people in Wesley's building died, including his wife, Elizabeth, also a photographer. They met at an exhibit 19 years ago. Wesley says it was love at first sight. He still can't believe she's gone.
It still feels like it happened yesterday, and every day I wake up... And not only when I wake up, but like at least 10 or 20 times a day, I say to myself, what in God's name happened? I mean, I still can't believe it. And I still can't believe that my wife is gone.
Wesley missed Elizabeth's funeral. He was still in the hospital. The day he was released, nearly 2 months after the quake, he and his daughter, Amara, moved to the U.S. to be near Wesley's family. And after months using a wheelchair, he's walking, nearly physically recovered, although he has some double vision because of a plate the doctors inserted beneath his eye. But he feels lucky. The private Mexican hospital that treated him didn't charge him anything. There were also fundraisers, including a photo auction.
All these people donated money. I don't even know them. There was a school in England. They donated money to me, and I like to think they were remembering my wife.
These days, Wesley and Amara, she's six now, live in Colorado Springs in a two-story home in the suburbs. From home, he runs a company that sells photography equipment. He also takes long bike rides. He doesn't know many people in Colorado. He chose the state for its mountains and as an affordable, safe place for Amara. She goes to first grade two blocks from home. Wesley picks her up every day. Colorado producer Meredith Turk tagged along on a recent afternoon.
Hola, mi amor. ¿Cómo estás? What is that? Oh, did you make that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, that's beautiful. Who gave it to you?
They're talking about a candy bracelet that Amara has on her wrist.
It's candy.
You can eat it.
It's
oh, that
candy.
Is awesome.
I get it from Treasure Box.
Before, Amara spoke just a bit of English, even though Wesley is from New York. Now she's becoming fluent. But they still switch over into Spanish, like when they lived in Mexico. Amara tells Wesley he got to school early to pick her up.
Pero llegaste temprano.
Sí, llegamos justo a tiempo.
Llegaste muy temprano.
Sí.
Muy temprano.
In the last year, Amara has become a big chess fan and loves math, a quality Wesley says did not come from him. Wesley has also spent a lot of time trying to find out why his apartment building collapsed. Mexican journalist reported that the same engineer who signed off on Wesley's building also approved two others that collapsed during quakes.
I naively thought that we were the victims of an act of Mother Nature. Really, the reason my building and a lot of other buildings collapse is because of just simple corruption.
Wesley is planning to sue over the building's collapse, though he's still not sure who to sue. The landlord? The Mexico City government? I asked him, what motivates him to take up a legal fight?
I hope to achieve a little bit of justice for my wife. If I can be a thorn in the side of people who are responsible for this, it will make me happy.
Last year, just days before the earthquake, it was Elizabeth's birthday, September 11th. The family, Wesley, Elizabeth, and Amara, went to a fancy restaurant in Mexico City. This year, Wesley and Amara went out for dinner alone in their adopted hometown. They also got a cake, lit candles, and sang Las Mañanitas, the Mexican birthday song, in her honor. She would have been 49. For the World, Emily Green, Mexico City.
And that's The World on this Wednesday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.